Good morning. My name is James E. Bloyd with the Cook County Department of Public Health. I'm going to give a brief introduction. This is session 4103.1, and we will be starting our presentation. Second at 10:50 will be Claudia Calhoun for Access Health NYC. At 11:10, Laura Merrifield, and at 11:30, Amy C. Paulson. So welcome, and we'd encourage folks from the back to definitely join us up front if you'd like. This is Cook County Place Matters, an alliance to advance health equity and labor wage policy, examining the work of Cook County Place Matters and Restaurant Opportunity Center, Chicago. So I'm delighted to be joined by Roberto Jesus Clack from Restaurant Opportunity Center, Chicago, and also Felipe Tendic Matasanz, Restaurant Opportunity Center United. We have no disclosures. The National Collaborative for Health Equity is the umbrella organization supporting our Cook County Place Matters team. And the National Collaborative has about 20 teams from around the United States. And I'm delighted to say also that the National Collaborative and Common Health Action just received a grant from Robert Wood Johnson to train leaders in multi-sector health work. So this is the Place Matters model. So it's a snapshot of the forces identified by our Place Matters teams that we seek to influence. So up on the upper left, you'll see education. Also, you'll see on the lower left, structural racism. We tend to focus also on the food system in the middle there, and also economic development and opportunity. And of course, the public health system, our practice and leadership, all are very important in helping to determine health inequities and health outcomes. I'd just like to point out that our team found that in a report in 2012, that here in Chicago, there are large gaps in life expectancy by average neighborhood income. Our county board president, Tony Preckwinkle, said at the press conference where we released this report that people living in areas with a median income greater than $53,000 per year have a life expectancy that is almost 14 years longer than people living in areas with a median income below $25,000 per year. So our report found evidence of a relationship between life expectancy and neighborhood income. We're using the World Health Organization's framework from Solar and Irwin of 2010 to focus on the structural determinants, the social determinants of health inequities, particularly here with our work in Cook County Place Matters. This involves the context on the left of governance, our labor market policies, and also our societal values. And these play out in the restaurant industry in Chicago. Also, the work of Place Matters and also of the Restaurant Opportunity Center Chicago involves structural oppression around gender and race. We see this in occupation and income, and the data that we'll be providing describes that. These, in turn, affect the intermediary determinants, the social determinants of health, in terms of material circumstances, like working conditions. Also, the health system as an intermediary determinant. So this impacts health equity and well-being. Also, most of us in the health sciences tend to have this approach to changing policy, to changing health policy. It's mostly a linear perspective where a problem is identified, we collect what we think is good scientific evidence, we translate it, and then we expect or we hope that there's action for policy change. But this is really not what most often happens. And I think if most of us think about it, we would see that. But nonetheless, this is the dominant model in health sciences. Instead, Patrick Fafard has described a political science approach to policy change in which there are dominant advocacy coalitions at the top that have more power, and less powerful advocacy coalitions at the bottom that affect the discourses and the narrative in the green circle and interact with the scientific evidence in the blue circle, ultimately changing public policy. So to wrap it up in my section, policymaking is a social process. Evidence is socially constructed. More powerful advocacy coalitions appropriate evidence as strategic resource for the desired policy outcomes. This is the quote from Fafard. I won't read that, but I encourage you to just look them up online in the references. I'm going to move on right away and introduce Roberto Jesus Clack. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Last time I was at McCormick Place, I was escorted out by security as our organization was protesting the National Restaurant Association trade show. The largest national restaurant worker organization in the country. We're proud to collaborate with Place Matters. But a lot of what we do, we understand, is happening in the context of low-wage workers achieving power, being able to create policies that help them in their day-to-day lives. We're the only advanced country in the world without paid sick days, paid family medical leave. Really, it's a shame. And a lot of why that happens is very political. So the National Restaurant Association, a lot of their largest contributors are McDonald's, the Darden Corporation, Yum Brand. So a lot of these things, it's all political, and we understand that. Working with Place Matters helps us have context of how that creates, poverty creates, specific health outcomes. But coming from a political background, we understand that a lot of these structures that create poor health for people happen because of power, because of political structures, and that there are corporations who actively lobby and really, shorten people's lives by advocating for the policies that they advocate for. So that's why this collaboration is important. We're just going to comment on a few of the campaigns. We are working on 6 days in Chicago, though, and we are going to pass it. But whenever we work on that, our main opposition is the National Restaurant Association, who just blanketly says we don't want any of it. The same with our One Fair Wage campaign. Just to give you a little context, the federal tip minimum wage has been $2.13 since 1991. It has not increased. So in Chicago, it's now we got a raise to $13 an hour going into effect by 2019. But the tip minimum wage is $5.45, which went up 50 cents from $4.95, and the final raise is going to be $5.95. So it's substantially less. If you go across the border to Indiana, it is a federal minimum wage of $2.13. And then another thing we know is that there's a huge gender component of this. Two-thirds of servers are women. So this is a huge women's issue, and customers are the ones who pay the wages of women. A lot of customers know this very well. They actually use that relationship to exploit people sexually. So even though 7% of women make up servers in our workforce, according to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, 37% of sexual harassment complaints are in the restaurant industry of the women working there. So I just think, and it's because of that component. And not only does this tip, the difference between the minimum wage and tip minimum wage create this issue of sexual discrimination and violence against women, but it's also an issue of poverty. We know that tip servers are twice as likely to live in a poverty. They're more likely than other workers in their workforce to have to depend on public services. I believe 46% of women depend on some sort of public assistance, so that, it's a huge issue. And so what we're working on as an organization is we're trying to eliminate the tip minimum wage. There's no reason that the employers cannot pay their employees. We have a high roads program where employers willingly pay it because they believe it creates a better business outcome and that they're actually more profitable by taking care of their workers. And, you know, so when these workers and multinational corporations cry poor, don't believe them. They're just being greedy. And, you know, we need more equity for our workers. So that is a campaign that we're working on. I do want to highlight that we have several reports and articles in the back table back there where you can learn more about our organization. So then the other thing that we see, and I think everyone sort of, I was a restaurant worker, so I always knew this anecdotally, is that there's tons of occupational segregation in the restaurant industry. You walk in the front door of most restaurants and you're going to see it right away. You know, white servers in the front of the house, people of color in the back of the house. This is the dynamic. All of our, we did the Great Service Divide report where we had testers go to try to, you know, with the same qualifications and to get a job. And people of color were 53% as likely with the same qualifications as their white counterparts to get jobs in front of the house positions, which front of the house positions, you know, there is a lot of poverty, but that is the, you know, you can get a living wage job if you're in a fine dining establishment. And what we find is that there's a disproportionate amount of white males who are concentrated in the best paying jobs in the restaurant industry. So a lot of people of color who are servers tend to work in, you know, the more casual dining environments, not the fine dining or better paying sort of positions. And you can kind of see how this breaks down here is, you know, so on the right, fine dining, 78% white, you know, 22% people of color. And you can kind of see the dynamic as you go down the chart. So there's just huge amounts of racial segregation as well as gender segregation. And this definitely leads to the amount of money you're going to have, your mobility within the industry. So these, you know, these are things that we, you know, we basically all know this, but, you know, doing the research, you know, corroborates everything that we've known about racial segregation. You know, the way we characterize it as an organization is that the occupational segregation in the restaurant industry is the Jim Crow of segregation. You know, and I think it's very important to understand that, you know, and also put it in the context of how this creates economic barriers for people of color and women in the industry. So, and then women concentrated in low pay sectors of the restaurant industry. We can see the breakdown here as well, where men tend to have the higher paying positions in the fine dining restaurants. So this is where I'm going to hand it off to Felipe.
Great. Thanks. I'll try to make it quick because I know we're wrapping it up here. So this is, you know, this is kind of where the rubber hits the road. A lot of our alliance, these are the results of what we've done together. And so some of the, you know, what I've explained to Jim and we've been talking about this a lot is, well, how has this alliance benefited us? So in one end, you know, what we've said is it's legitimized our research because we do participatory-based research. And a lot of, you know, when you talk about discussion of power, who dictates what the narrative is going to be is usually those in power. And so what helps us is collaborations like with Cook County, you know, Department of Public Health. And when we can work together in collaboration and say, listen, this entity that's recognized as like a research entity is also an entity for public health. They recognize our statistics. They're recognizing what we're bringing to the table, and which is changing the dynamic of the conversation. And so that's just one step forward for us. The relationship also ended up with an ad that we were able to post in the New York Times, actually during the National Restaurant Association's national meeting, policy meeting in D.C. This year, we actually blockaded their group where they weren't able to lobby their congressman on time, and we actually brought in some of our partners, a lot of them were restaurant owners, to give a counter conversation, which is the first time in history, let me just say that this is the first time in history that a group like this has ever done this in this country. This happened last year, that happened this year, and every year we kind of spice it up a little bit. We came this year and interrupted them during their national trade show, and the point is that we're putting pressure. It's the counter. It's the David and Goliath story, except we've beaten up on Goliath now, and we're starting to see that they're getting annoyed, and that's our goal, is to really question their power and the conversation. And the narrative has begun to change. And so I'll just briefly touch on this because I think we have like a minute left, but
4 minutes.
4 minutes? Oh, okay. Look at that. I'm not talking for a minute. So this is a power analysis grid. I was mentioned. This is a way to look at power and to begin discussions on strategy on how to change the power dynamics. So I'm not going to get into too much detail with it, but just to simply say that you define your agenda, you always have to know your opponent's agenda, and you start having discussions about, well, where do we actually have power? And it starts to advance the discussion of, okay, what makes most sense for creating a strategy? And this is what we've been working on as a group with Place Matters, is having this larger conversation. Just to highlight, Place Matters is a group of a lot of different organizations, so it's not just us. We just happen to be involved, and really this is where we, through the power analysis process, we discover that our issue actually affects almost every organization that we're working with, and it makes the most sense to target these discussions. And this is another quick slide that I'll just quickly speak to, is just these are the major elements of health equity practice. We want to give kind of a shout out to NACHO for coming up with these, and they've helped guide us in our process. But I would highlight the biggest is the building the base. And what that basically is, without, you know, it's called organizing. And at the core of everything we do, any kind of change, any kind of discussion about health equity practice, any kind of issue with, you're going to deal with power, and you're going to have to build power yourself, and that's going to be through organizing, through entities that organize folks for better workplace practices, to community organizations that organize folks for stronger communities. It all comes down to that basic practice of organizing. And these are some of our references. And I think we're at the end. We have time for one question really quickly, and we can add it to the end.
So please take our reports, but if you don't want to carry them, I understand. Go to rockunited.org, and it's just a really great resource for research done on the restaurant industry. It's the second largest private industry in the country. In Illinois, according to the Illinois Restaurant Association, it's actually the largest private employer. So this is a huge part of our workforce and growing workforce. So it's very important that we understand it. But the website is a huge resource. So please go to it and download any of the reports you're interested in.
Well, we've been around since ROC actually started as a result of the terrorist attack on the trade towers. Displaced workers in a restaurant called Windows on the World started the organization in New York. And so we've been at this since around 2002, these conversations. Place Matters, we've always kind of, our analysis of power and theory of change has evolved through the years. But we've always noticed and known that it's important to make strong alliances with government and try to work with different departments. Naturally, the Department of Public Health has always kind of been a fit because it's their duty, to really serve the public health of the community. And 99% of all our discussions are actually a public health conversation. So we have pursued relationships, but really this is a relationship that started between Jim and I, and we had begun that in Chicago. We can carry on this question towards the end. Hopefully there's some time to talk some more, but I don't want to cut into other people's time. So